welcome to the Over and Back Classic NBA Podcast. I am Jason, and with you as usual is Rich. Hello, Rich.
What is going on?
Not a whole lot. We're diving through these 50-point games, of course, splitting them up into era. We've gotten through, you know, the vast scoring of Wilt, and now we're getting into the swinging late 60s and 70s.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about a lot of different names here. I think, which is good though, because I enjoyed that the last show we did a lot more of, you know, just kind of diving into Wilt and these insane Wilt facts or whatnot, which is important in this series. But I think this also becomes cool too, because like we're going to talk about a bunch of different names in this era, and it kind of fits as we've always sort of talked about this era in NBA history, the late 60s and the 70s is just like a bizarre era in NBA and you know, basketball history and professional basketball history, because you get the inclusion of the ABA. So a lot more teams, a lot more players, a lot more sort of oddities. So I'm looking forward to this episode.
Yeah, it's a fun one. And this is definitely an era. Up to this point, we're starting in 67. So from 49 to 66, we've had 18 players with 50 or more in a game. It's been done 169 times. 116 of those by Wilt Chamberlain. So if you take Wilt out of the equation, it's even more rare. But it's a relatively small club. All of them eventual Hall of Famers, with the exception of Rudy LaRusso, even though he was a five-time All-Star, you know, pretty good star player. But looking at the next few seasons up through 74, we're going to have 35 new members of the club in just, you know, eight seasons, 21 of those in the Hall of Fame. So a lot more players, obviously, a lot fewer Hall of Famers, a lot of chances for, you know, kind of weird random guys that most modern fans probably haven't heard of. Even a few guys here I'm a little, you know, iffy on. So it's a fun opportunity to dive into some obscure guys, as you were alluding to.
Yeah, no, and it's an interesting fact, too, that everybody but LaRusso were eventual Hall of Famers. And that's, to me, kind of odd, because, you know, these days, and we did, you know, one of our shows earlier in the series where we talked about just sort of the most random 50-point games or whatnot. And there was plenty to choose from, you know what I mean? There was plenty of guys that we could have kind of dove into. But at this point, like, yeah, there's really no unlikely 50-point scorers. I mean, everybody that's scored it is basically like, yeah, well, they're the elite of the elite, the best of the best. And Rudy LaRusso, who's the only lone, you know, non-Hall of Famer, as you said, isn't like a nobody or nothing. He's still, you know, a five-time All-Star and still a pretty good player, but probably just right out on the cusp of being a Hall of Famer. Whereas now we're going to get to some guys that it's like, I didn't hear about them until, you know, their name appeared on the stock. And that's pretty fun, though, to start getting into this era now, too, where maybe it doesn't become a little bit easier, but it, we get a few different unique names in here. So,
yeah. And, looking at the seasons from 67 through 74, there were 84 50-plus games at all. This is down from 127 from the last period we looked at, which was 62 to 66, so obviously fewer seasons. Wilt had 100 of those 127, so obviously just accounting for a huge percentage of that. Rick Barry is going to be the star of this era. 17 50-plus point games during this time, 22 for his entire career. Also, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is going to have quite a few, and Will Chamberlain's going to have a few as well. He's going to kind of wrap up his scoring binges here. He's going to have a few coming up, especially the next two seasons. And 1.06% of all games were 50-plus during this time. And 62 had the record with 15%, and you know, there were, looking at this era, you're looking usually like 3 or 4% the prior era. Now we're getting down to the point where we're getting a new league, getting more games. You know, we're going to have higher numbers of players and higher numbers of rates, but it's going to be a smaller percentage because there are so many more games going on.
Right. Yeah, you've added teams, you've added leagues, you've just increased everything about the league and added a complete other league. But yeah, it's the actual percentages are going to go down a little bit, even though, we're seeing a few more names and, yeah, obviously a few more games, like you said. But I don't think nothing's going to top that 1962. But yeah, it's still pretty fun nonetheless.
Yes. Yeah. And then average true shootings for the NBA shooting percentage in this era, 50.5%, which is up from 48.6% in the previous era. So guys are starting to be a little more efficient in their shooting. So,
yeah. And we'll obviously, with the ABA, we'll get into, you know, the 3-point shot as well. Right. Playing a big factor in, you know, three is more than two, and if you shoot some threes and throw those in there, obviously nobody was quite prolific, or there are no Klay Thompsons in these days, but no. There were a few guys that benefited by having, you know, a shot that was worth a few more points. So
absolutely Yeah. So, and we're drawing down on the absolutely huge scoring bin era. 67 is 1.7% of regular season games are 50 plus. This is with a 10th team added to the NBA, the Bulls. In 68, we go down below 1%, which is the first time since the late 50s that was the case. We get the first year of the ABA and the 11th and 12th teams added to the NBA. So we go from 405 total games played, 921, which just I kind of imagine doubling the amount of games that are played, in pro basketball in just one season is pretty dramatic. And then we're going to be pretty much below 1% of games being 50 plus, with the exception of a few different random eras, including the early 70s. And then we've kind of had a spate of them in the last few years. Again, 2017, 2018, and 2019 is guaranteed to finish above 1%. But outside of a few other small stretches, not really. That's a pretty rare thing. So this is where we're winding down in this as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
67, we have 9 50-plus games, and Rick Barry has 7 of them. This is his second season in the league. And Will Chamberlain changes his role. He only has 1 for the entire season. And this is, of course, famously the year where he, the Philadelphia 76ers get Alex Hannum as coach and built around Wilt being more of a defensive and playmaking force. And he still has some great scoring, but it is it's down from those peaks. And, coincidentally, not coincidentally, he has his greatest team success as the Sixers win 68 wins. They get 68 wins and they dethrone the Celtics for the championship.
Yeah. So, traded in some of the scoring binges for a ring. So, yeah. He had the scoring, he had all that, but I was missing something big in his life. And that was, the success in right. the NBA. So he finally did get it here, even though, his scoring is now kind of taken a back seat and the team has improved for it. So.
Right. Absolutely. So, so going through a few of the games from the 67 season, Rick Barry, his first is on October 29th, 66, 57 points. I think it's his second overall 50 plus. He had won the previous season. And then he has an ignoble mark on December 8th, 66, where he records the worst non-Wilt true shooting percentage in a 50-plus point game in NBA history, 47.9%, which is only like slightly below like league average. So I guess it's not really that
right,
bad.
Right.
But yes, usually they're generally much higher. Obviously, if you're taking that many, if you're scoring, usually obviously taking a lot of shots, but you're making them too. So he also has the second Christmas 50 ever. And then Wilt's comes on February 13th, 1967. He had 58 points, 25 rebounds, 6 assists on 72 true shooting percentage. And that is his 116th of his career and his first after the age of 30.
Yeah, it's just a pretty interesting thing to see now as he's sort of adjusting. And yeah, we're going to come up with some fun facts here. With Wilt's, his next few 50-point games, but now every single time you're going to kind of talk about it, it's different, it's unique. You know what I mean? Like it's not going to be commonplace anymore with him. There's going to be ones that stand out. There's going to be little things that he does in these that are pretty fun. But this is the first one here, and unfortunately, there's not going to be that many more, which is interesting.
Right? Yeah, he's winding down in that, absolutely. So then Barry on February 14th and February 16th, he has 50 plus in back-to-back games. He's the first other than Wilt and Elgin Baylor to do that. And then we get into the playoffs, March 28th, 67, Sam Jones with 51 points. That is the ninth 50 plus in playoff history. He also breaks his own record for the oldest player to score 50 plus, which would last until 1978. This happens in a series clinching game 4 against the Knicks. This is the third 50-plus point game in Celtics history, and 2 of those had been in the playoffs. So,
yeah, that's fun. Yeah, I like breaking your own record for the oldest player. Go ahead and do that, Sam.
Yeah, way to go. Yeah, nice deal. And then Rick Barry caps off his history-making season, or history-making for him, certainly. I guess non-Wilt history-making season. With his 55 in the playoffs, actually in the finals, in fact, the third time that's happened in the finals. He has 55, 12, and 5, 48 true shooting. So another low mark in that regard. And uncharacteristically, he's 11 of 19 from the free throw line. So I know.
Come on, Rick. I mean, yeah, I mean, there's ways to make free throws. Why would he just not do that? I don't know. For somebody who, you know, we never miss an opportunity to laugh anytime Rick Barry does have a game where he doesn't like make every free throw.
Sure.
Because he's such an ass when people miss free throws. So,
a little bit.
You know, we have to do that to him. So that's fine.
Absolutely.
We have a love hate with Rick.
Oh, yeah, we do. We do. More hate perhaps, but you know,
we love to hate him.
I think that's sort of the story of Rick Barry's career. People love to hate him. Right. So,
yeah, love to hate him.
A great player. And I think honestly, like one thing, you know, obviously he's one of the great players in NBA history, that he was, you know, a scoring force, a playmaking force, a revolutionary in terms of switching leagues and gaining a lot for player rights and, you know, and really a transcendent player in a lot of ways. And because of the era that he played in, kind of, you know, forgotten a little bit unfairly. And I think I appreciate even more just seeing like, wow, he had these scoring binges that are up there with, you know, among the best players in NBA history, you know, non-Wilt edition. I mean, he's, you know, he's fifth or sixth on the list all time in terms of number of games. So that's pretty incredible. Plus, you know, I don't even necessarily think of scoring as absolutely the number one thing that he did really well. I mean, he was such a great playmaker. He was, you know, he was really good at all facets of the game. He was a great just offensive player overall. A little bit like LeBron, where LeBron's, you know, he's obviously a fantastic scorer up there in the all-time list, but, you know, he does so many other things well, you don't even necessarily think of scoring as his primary weapon.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as well, we kind of discovered a little bit more in our basketball mysteries of the 70s of how important he was to the ABA as well when he moved over there and obviously bringing, you know, a star to that league or whatnot. So obviously, yeah, he's a guy that probably does get underappreciated legacy-wise compared to, you know, where he probably should be.
Yeah. So diving into 68. So Rick Barry is going to sit out this year because he has defected to the ABA but has to sit out a year because of not playing his option year, the option clause issue that the NBA was still restricted under. He had to sit out the year rather than go to his ABA team. So that gives the opportunity for other players to step in, and it's Will Chamberlain, his last stand. He has four 50-point games this year out of the eight total. This is the first year for the ABA, so they are bringing in some too. There are two in the ABA, six in the NBA, and we have four new members of the 50-plus club.
Yeah, we do. We have Willis Reed, Larry Jones, Earl Monroe, and Louis Dampier. I can't in good conscience talk about Larry Jones. I think you have to because he is one of your native sons.
Yes.
So go ahead.
Columbus, Ohio's own Larry Jones from where I live.
From your house? You live in Larry Jones' house?
I literally live in Larry Jones' house. Yeah, right here, right now.
Yeah, right. Larry, bring him on the show. I mean, come on. I know he's shy.
He's really shy, yeah. Otherwise, he would have, yes. So he had a short stint with the 76ers in 1965. Then he spent 2 years in the Eastern League before finding a spot with the Denver Rockets in the ABA's first season. And in his first trip to play in Pittsburgh, Jones stayed on the team plane to escape a subpoena by the Eastern League that disputed his jump to the ABA. So that's always fun. He was known primarily as a terrific jump shooter. He was a four-time ABA All-Star, actually led the ABA points per game in the 69 season, and was the first ABA player with 5,000 career points. So also important in terms of labor rights for the ABA, he was the ABA All-Star Game MVP in 1970, and before that led a threatened strike before the game as the ABA Players Union president. So he gained some concessions through that. Similar, of course, the more famous story with Elgin Baylor and Bob Cousy and all the other, you know, mm-hmm. ABA or NBA All-Stars in the early 60s. And then he ended up being traded from Denver after a salary dispute. He once protested by wearing a railroad suit, claiming that was all he could afford. I believe that story is in Loose Balls. And also, yeah, after that, teamed with Matt Calvin in a high-scoring backcourt for the Miami Floridians before bouncing around the ABA, ending his career actually again with the Sixers a little bit in the late 70s. And then later, he'd become the director of player personnel in the Women's Professional Basketball League in the late 70s, early 80s, and did some coaching. So
yeah, good for him.
That's very career.
Columbus,
yeah.
His very own, yeah.
Yeah.
It appears here that I'm hoping you don't see him because it appears that he worked as a state corrections officer
Right.
In Columbus. So it's a good thing you probably have not run into Larry Jones that often.
No.
In Columbus. But yeah, pretty cool stuff there. So as mentioned, Willis Reed, I wouldn't have to really tell you too much more about Willis Reed. You probably know about him. Irv Monroe, we've talked about a bunch here. And Louis Dampier, if you go back to our basketball mysteries of the 70s, I think you'll hear a little bit about Louis Dampier. He's one of the early three-point shooting. He wasn't that great at it, but he took a hell of a lot of them. So yeah. Good for him.
Yeah.
In the NBA.
Yeah. He was.
I think he was fine. Like,
yeah, he
for
was fine.
Time, obviously.
Right.
Yeah. Like nobody. No. Knew how to do it, so
sure.
Like, yeah, but yeah, he's one of the first guys. There was quite a few, but yeah, he was one of the kind of the probably the best of those early guys at taking the three pointer. So pretty cool stuff from him. But yeah, this is all significant too because Rick Barry. You'll notice that we have not mentioned him once before or once yet. And this year, it's because he sat out the year because he was going to defect to the ABA. So we mentioned how important he was to the ABA, but yeah, at this point, he sits out the year. So that's why no Rick Barry here. It's not like he had an uncharacteristically bad year. He just didn't play. So.
Right, yeah, can't score 50 if you don't play. So
no, real quickly here, we kind of do these little look-ins here at like where this era ranks and where it compares to this year and all time. So just kind of give you an idea: the average field goal attempts for 50-point games in this era, 1967 to 74, 34.7. The average free throw attempts for 50-point games in this era, 14.2. And the average true shooting percentage, you mentioned it a little bit earlier, but for the entire era, 66% for this time. Just going to give you an idea where that compares. Average field goal attempts for 50-point games, NBA history, 34.3. So almost right on the money there with 34. For the ABA, it's a little trickier because it's kind of incomplete stats, but 35.8 is the field goal attempts. Our 50-point games, but again, it's incomplete, and there's 10, 15 games that we don't really have all that data for, so it's a little tricky to do that there. Average free throw attempts for 50-point games in the NBA, 14.9. Again, right, pretty close there with 14.2 in this era to 14.9 overall. And then average free throw attempts for 50-point games in ABA history, 13.2, so a little bit under there. Average true shooting percentage, NBA history for 50-point games, 66, so exactly the same as we had in this era, and average true shooting percentage for ABA, 65.5. So again, right on the money there with this era. And then just kind of give you an idea where it ranks in terms of 2019, 31.6 is the amount of field goal attempts in this year's 50-point games, whereas average field goal attempts 50-point games in this era, 34.7. So obviously far less. The three-pointer plays a big part in that. Average free throw attempts, pretty close. 14.1 this year, 14.2 in this era, and then average true shooting percentage. 2019, you probably don't need us to tell you this. It's going to be a very large. 72.2 is the average true shooting percentage for 50-point games. This year, in this era, it's going to be 66. So it makes all the sense in the world that that'd be sort of the numbers there. But yeah, I'm kind of fascinated that the free throw attempts have remained pretty steady throughout this entire process.
Yeah, that is interesting for sure. A couple of things I wanted to mention about the 68 games, especially Wilt's, because he has some really interesting ones here.
Yeah, yeah.
December 1st, 67, he has 52, 37, and 2. He sets a record for the worst free throw percentage in a 50-plus point game, 8 for 30 for 27%. But he still has a 61 true shooting percentage because he's a 22 of 29 from the floor. So still pretty good, despite despite 27% from free throw shooting. So on so many attempts. Just 15 days later, he has 68, 34, and 2. This is his eighth and final 60-30 game ever. Very, very few other players have accomplished that, and he did it 8 times. No one else, I think, has done it more than once. Also, 8 of 22 from the free throw line, still not very good. And then just 4 days later, December 20th, his best field goal percentage in a 50-plus point game, 20 out of 23, is 53 points, 38 rebounds, 6 assists. And then toward the end of the season, on March 18th, he has his second 50-plus triple-double, which he has 53, 32, and 14. His last 50-plus with the Sixers franchise, and he has 11 total with them. He sets records for most rebounds in a triple-double, which is obviously still active. Not a lot of people getting 32 rebounds in a triple-double. And also, he had the most assists in a 50-plus point triple-double until the 2017 season. And also set a record for field goal an overall NBA record for field goal percentage in a game with 30-plus field goal attempts, because he was 24 out of 29, 82%. And this is the 120th 50-plus point game of his career.
Yeah, that's remarkable. Real quickly, too, for this year before we move on, we were mentioning again the 3-point line and the ABA obviously bringing the 3-point line into this. Larry Jones, our first 50-pointer, taking a 3-pointer. He made one. We don't know how many he took because records are a little incomplete. But we do know then later in the year, Louis Dampier, who we mentioned, 4 of 7 from three. To get to his 50-point game. So that's nice. The only two there where we have any 3-pointers in there, but it's going to start becoming kind of a regular commonplace thing here in a bit, so we'll talk about it when that happens. But yeah, Larry Jones is your official first guy to hit 50 while shooting a three, so or making a three, I should say. So
yes, exactly, yes. So going into 1969, we have 9 games overall, 4 in the NBA, 5 in the ABA. Our leaders are Will Chamberlain with 2, including his final 50-plus game, and 2 by Connie Hawkins, the only 2 of his pro career outside of an ABL game that we talked about in the early 60s. And this year we have 4 new members of the 50-plus club.
Yeah, this is going to be a fascinating, you know, we keep adding these new names and new numbers and new guys. And I'm going to go over these real quick, and then we'll talk about guys here a little bit. We have Elvin Hayes, a new member, Daryl Carrier, who we'll talk about in a bit, Connie Hawkins, and Mel Daniels. We'll kind of give a magnifying glass here to Elvin Hayes, because this is his rookie season, and he'd be the last rookie to lead the league in points per game, which I think is kind of a fascinating. I guess it makes sense, because even like the best rookies, it still is kind of tough. But I don't know, for some reason, that does that stat kind of surprise you in any way, or no? Do you kind of believe that would be the case?
I guess it doesn't completely shock me. I mean, I don't know. You might think like Kareem would have done it, or right. Like, there's a handful of guys who you could have seen doing it, but you know, obviously,
or just, yeah, some guy on a bad team. You know what I mean? Like a guy gets drafted number one overall by some crap team or whatever, and they're like, all right, dude, just do everything. You know, we need you to do like. But I guess it is trickier than we think to step in and be the leading scorer.
And most rookies don't. It obviously takes a while to come along and you really be an elite scorer. I mean, you're going to have to score 25 points per game at least, you know, to lead the league in scoring and more most seasons. So that's pretty hard to do for a rookie. I would imagine, again, it's probably only been done by, you know, Hayes, Chamberlain, and maybe one or two other players.
Yeah. All right, so some other stats I hear on Hayes. He would also lead the NBA twice in rebounds per game, 6-time All-Star, 3 times, or sorry, 6-time All-NBA, 3 times All-NBA first team, and then also a 12-time All-Star. Yes, that sounds more right. It's like 6-time All-Star. Elvin Hayes, come on, he had to do more. Primary scoring weapon, of course, is turnaround jumper, famous turnaround jumper. He missed a total of 9 games in his entire career. He never played fewer than 80 games in a season and only missed 2 games in 7 seasons as a Rocket. That is unbelievable. 9 games his entire career.
Right.
You know, yeah. Like, what the? Yeah. He played a while. Like, it's not a guy who had like a 5-year career. Like, no, he was there for a long, long time. It's incredible. I played his last season for the Rockets in San Diego, the first season for the Rockets in Houston, the last season for the Bullets in Baltimore, and the first season for the Bullets in Washington. So that is either good or bad. I don't know. It seems either moved because of Elvin or
it's weird. You know, I think that's so that works. Yeah.
I can't tell if that's good or bad.
But. Yeah. I found that one quite fascinating as I was doing a little basketball reference, which I just feel like I had to throw that one in there, even though.
Yeah,
nothing to do with nothing, but it's, you know, a lot of moving there, you know?
Yeah, so. It's interesting there. 12th all time in points, 6th all time in rebounds, 15th all time in rebounds per game. And despite, his, you know, appearances on those all time leaderboards we mentioned there, all the kind of the credentials, he's, you know, pretty much forgotten in terms of like the conversations that you have with, you know, all time conversations or, you know, best players of all time. And it maybe speaks to this era a little bit, or it speaks to something. I don't know. But yeah, you're right. He just doesn't really pop up on many people's radars, which is a tragedy.
Yeah, right. It's interesting. Yeah, because I mean, he had a lot of team success too. It wasn't like he was stuck. I mean,
right.
I mean, the Bullets were not like a glamour team by any means, but they won a championship. I mean, they were, you know, one of the bigger teams at the time. But yeah, he's almost kind of been completely looped out of that. And he's another guy where the personality was considered prickly, and you know, there's kind of issues there. And obviously, I think the bigger issues because kind of the era that he played in, the footage isn't necessarily there. His era isn't celebrated like the, you know, 60s and 80s and 90s are. So it's one of those things, but I, definitely. And, you know, honestly, we did not include him in our 50 greatest players we did a few years ago. He was kind of one of the last cutoffs where we were kind of unsure about that one. So, you know, maybe even did a little bit too.
We're guilty. Yeah. We're guilty. Yes.
There you go. Yes. You know, really the Connie Hawkins games, we don't really have complete stats for. He had 57 on November 27th, 1968, and 53 on December 5th, 1968. And But looking at going into, you know, the last two for Will Chamberlain, he had these are the last two of his career. His first was January 26, 1969. He had 60 at 21. His first, of course, for the Lakers. And then his final one is on February 9th, 1969. And pretty good way to go. 66 points, 27 rebounds, four assists. At that point, he had 122 out of the 191 total 50-plus point games in Pro Hoops history at that point.
Jesus.
he had 32 of the 60-point games out of 40 total. This is also the only 66-point pro game ever it recorded. And this was the last 60-20 game until Shaq reached that point in 2000. And he has 28 of the 32 60-20 games ever.
There you go. Yeah, man. Wilt, I'm going to miss you, man. I'm going to miss you. I'm glad we have new names, but I'm going to miss these Wilt facts. Like, nobody, I mean, there's going to be some fun 50-point games coming up, but nobody's got, like, the Wilt facts. You know, these things are just nuts. Like, I love going out with 66, too.
Right.
That's the way to go,
man. There you go.
It's just 66. Put it right on him, you know? I love it.
Yeah,
it's great.
I like that no one has ever done that before. So that's a fun one. So, yes, Mel Daniels. This season he has 56 in March of 69. Joins the 50-30 club with at that time was George Mikan, Wilt, Elgin Baylor, and Bob Pettit. The first 50 plus for the Pacers, the only one of his career. He also had, as I said, 31 rebounds in that game. So crosses there. Larry Jones accomplished it for the second time in his career, and then Jerry West caps off our 1969 season with 53 points, three rebounds, 10 assists. This is in the NBA Finals, the 11th time in playoff history that this has happened, the fourth time in the finals. And this is his final 50-plus point game, the seventh of his career, which is a little bit more than I kind of would have expected from West. And, mm-hmm. and part of it is obviously he's got a few in the 62 and 63 during that scoring binge era. But another guy, like, obviously I think of him as a really good scorer, but I don't necessarily think of that like as his primary skill, but obviously he could do it.
Yeah, I feel if him is more of like kind of floor general guy that's kind of leading everybody else, and of course, yeah, he's going to score out there a little bit, but yeah, we mentioned it in a prior episode too. He doesn't really strike you as a guy that was going to just explode for like those big scoring binges, and he did a few times. So we're bidding adieu to many of the greats of the years past with this one. But one guy I wanted to mention before we move on to 1970 here, Daryl Carrier, who I mentioned a little bit at the top, he goes 7 of 12 from 3-point land to get his 53 points in November 18th. 1968. So I think this is, you know, we had Louis Dampier the year prior. He did, you know, 4 of 7 from the 3-point line. This is 7 of 12. I mean, this is a guy who largely did a lot of his work, you know, at the 3-point line, and can attribute a lot of the points that he scored in this game to the 3-pointer, which is, I think, you know, between him and Louis, really the first time we've seen anybody do that. And Daryl is the first guy to really just pour it on from three, and would be it, you know, it'd stand for quite a few number of years. We'll talk about it in a bit, but I mean, that's 7 3-pointers in a 50-point game. It's going to be quite a while until we get that again. I think, geez, if I'm looking, I'm just kind of doing a quick little scroll. It might be until 1995. Until someone scores 7 3-pointers a game, or shoots 7 3-pointers in a game to get to 50. So it's a interesting little note there for Daryl Carrier. So he's another one of the guys like Louis Dampier who saw that 3-point line and said, I'm going to shoot from there. Right. See what happens. And it works.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
And you wrote a good piece a few years ago on Carrier and Dampier kind of being the, you know, the Splash Brothers, you know, of their era of, you know, they were the backcourt for the Kentucky Colonels. They were like, light it up at, you know, a huge rate, obviously, for the time, and really at an unprecedented rate until at least, you know, starting, you know, mid to late 90s when the 3-point rate started to kind of be near where they were had been in the ABA at its peak. So
I forgot about that article. Thank you. I forgot. I wrote that. That is a great article. You are right. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So so now moving into a new decade, the 1970s, and we have in the 1970 season itself 8 games total, 3 in the NBA, 5 in the ABA, and this is we're getting expansion in the NBA, so we have bigger leagues, we got more games. We've gone from we went to 900 from 405 to 921 into 68. Then we have a 1,003 in 69 and just 1,036 the next in 70. So not that big of a jump from season to season. And the highest we'll reach will be in 71, 72. We'll have 1,159. And we won't have that number again until the mid 90s. We won't cross that market again until that point. So It took a long time for that to happen, of course, for NBA expansion to catch up to the point where it was the same number of games as the early 70s, which is kind of wild to think about.
Yeah, that's nuts. I mean, it's still a lot of professional basketball, especially in a country that wasn't really, I mean, like, enjoyed it. But yeah, it's just kind of fascinating that this is the time period where they decided, like, hey, you know what? Like, the whole ABA thing, and we talked about it before, it's just like, it's amazing that it lasted beyond, you know, a half of a year or whatever.
Right.
And it almost barely didn't. So it was close there for a bit. But yeah, it's just like odd to be like, you know what this world needs is like double the amount of professional basketball games at this period. Just seems like a weird period to do that. But hey, it worked.
Yes. Yes, so some notable things about this season. Rick Barry, he is again the leader with a whopping two games this year. The previous year, he did play, but only played 35 games and because of injury, and he was on a stacked team that ended up winning the ABA Finals. He did have 10 out of those 35 or 40-plus, including one 49-point game. So he got close, but not quite to 50 the previous year, but he gets back on the board in the 1970 season. And one big thing is we set a record of new members of 50-plus point club with 5.
Yes. Yeah, we got 5 new members here. We have Roger Brown, a guy we talked a lot about in our basketball mysteries of the 1970s series. Spencer Haywood, Billy Cunningham, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. It's a silly name. Nobody's going to remember that one. And then Lou Hudson also came here. So Kareem, I don't know anything about that guy. I guess we could try to do some research. Maybe on our next episode, we'll talk
right,
about
we'll
Kareem.
See.
Or maybe, I don't know, like maybe we could, I don't know. I'm saying we could maybe do like a series that's largely, you know, where we talk about him quite a lot or something. I mean, maybe in the best one of the 70s, he came up a few times. I don't know. Maybe. Go back and listen. He might have came up a few times. But
yeah.
The guy we're going to talk about here a little bit more, Lou Hudson. Another smooth jump shooter as well. One of the players who never made the Hall of Fame. And it's like, really? How did Lou Hudson not make the Hall of Fame? He's not quite like the, you know, we have our list of ones that we get very angry about. I don't know if Lou Hudson always is added on that list, but maybe we should retroactively add him to that list.
And honestly, like the longevity wasn't super there. So he's someone where I look at the numbers and I'm like, oh, I kind of guess why he's not in, but he kind of should be in, but I don't know.
I'm not going to get too upset because it's like the Basketball Hall of Fame and I don't care all that much, but like still, come on.
Yeah,
why not?
I'm always in favor of honoring guys. So yeah.
Yeah, more people. Right. I want the big hall. I want a big basketball Hall of Fame. But anyway, of Hall of Fame eligible players, he is 6th in Hall of Fame probability, which is a Basketball Reference stat they have for probability to make the Hall of Fame. Of course, for reference, he's right in between Klay Thompson and Kyle Lowry. So, that's like such a weird delineation too, because like Klay Thompson, I would say, yeah, he's a Hall of Famer, and then Kyle Lowry, I'd be like, eh, I don't know. So I guess that's exactly where Lou Hudson should probably be, is between those two guys. But yeah, it's interesting there. 6-time All-Star, 1-time All-NBA second team, so that probably doesn't help his Hall of Fame eligibility there. 1973, he and Pete Maravich became the second set of teammates to score 2,000 points in a season. Elgin Baylor and Jerry West were the first ones to do that. Hudson appeared in the basketball movie. This Hall of Fame worthy on its own. The basketball movie, The Fish That Saved Pittsburgh. It's in 1979, in case you want to go back and watch it. Moved to Park City, Utah after he retired, and he was elected to the city council in 1993, and he's believed to have been the first African-American elected official in Utah, and his campaign signs read "Sweet Lou for You," which is a great good name.
Yeah, good slogan. Yeah. Have you seen The Fish That Saved Pittsburgh?
You know, I did as a kid, and I have not seen it in forever, and I don't know why. I should really go back and watch it. Is it good? Like, I remember enjoying it as a kid, but does it hold up?
You know, I have not seen it, so I don't know. That's an omission for me. I have never, as far as I don't remember seeing it as a kid. So I'm pretty sure that I've never seen it.
Yeah, I think I went through a thing where I was just watching a bunch of old basketball movies or like any movie that had basketball at all. So like I maybe not even understood it when I was like 10 watching it or whatever. So maybe I should go back and watch. But obviously it's got, you know, Julius Erving, like a little Metalogue Lemon in there. It seems like a movie that I really like. So I should go back and watch it. It's a time period I love too. I love the 70s, especially the late 70s. The music's awesome. The fashion's great. So I should really go. Yeah, I should really go back and watch it.
We'll look into that. Yeah. So.
Marv Albert's in it? Oh, my God. Now I got to watch it.
Oh, well, yeah, obviously.
Marv Albert and Chick Hearn and the Spinners? Oh, come on.
Oh, wow. Oh.
Three of my favorite things.
Yeah.
Marv Albert, Chick Hearn, and the Spinners.
Right there. Looking at just at a few of the key games, we have Rick Barry breaks his drought with his first 50-plus since 1967. This is in March of 1970. And then we have we've got a bunch in late in the season. We have two in March, three in April, and one in May. And three of the four in April and May are playoff games. This sets a record for the most. This is the first season with a 350-plus point playoff games. The only other time that's ever happened would be 2001. So yes, Billy Cunningham has the 12th in playoff history. The only 50-plus of his career. Spencer Haywood on April 15th, he has 59. He sets a pro record for the youngest at 50-plus, which will be broken by LeBron in 2005. He is, the 30th player to cross the 50-plus point threshold. And then Rick Barry has the first in ABA playoff history, 52 points, 13 rebounds, 6 assists. This is against the... this is Washington against Denver. That was kind of an interesting little playoff series at that point. Rick Barry against Spencer Haywood. And then Roger Brown, he has the first and only in ABA finals history. And he had 53, 39, and 45 in the final three games of the 1970 ABA finals, in which the Pacers beat the LA Stars. So.
Yeah, it's a great, great series there. And yeah. Unfortunately, I misspoke in the prior year when I said that Louis Dampier or Daryl Carrier's 7 of 12 from three would last until 1995. It actually only lasted the next year. And then I think it lasts until 1995 because Louis Dampier put up 9 threes in his 55-point game earlier this year as well. So, yeah, 21 shots, 9 of them from three. So it's a pretty interesting little number there. But now I can officially declare that it's going to last until 1995. So.
All right. Very good. Well, thank you for clarifying the record. We always let you do that here. So going back to 1971, and we are we're exploding in number of games. We got 14 in all, 5 in the NBA, 9 in the ABA, and our leaders. Well, we have 4 different leaders who had two games that year: Rick Barry, Dan Issel getting on the board, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and John Brisker. And in terms of new members, we set a record again with 7 new members in the 50-plus point club.
John Brisker, who again has a fascinating story, so if, we talked about it again in our basketball mystery series, but definitely do some reading on John Brisker if you can. He is one of the more fascinating figures in pro basketball history, so we'll leave it at that. Joe Caldwell, Walt Wesley, Dave Bing, Stu Johnson, Dan Issel, and Steve Snapper Jones. A few guys we want to talk about here. Stu Johnson was the one that I had never heard about before I saw him on this doc, and I was like, all right, Stu Johnson, let's see what we can do here. He's a graduate of Murray State, so you know he's we know who he's rooting for in this NCAA tournament is Murray State, but he spent the 1966-67 season in the North American Basketball League with the Benton Harbor Twin City Sailors and then later the Holland Carvers. So interesting, auspicious start to his pro basketball career. Then he played 9 seasons in the ABA, but with 7 different franchises: the Kentucky Colonels, the New Jersey Americans / the New York Nets, the Houston Mavericks, the Pittsburgh Pipers / the Pittsburgh Condors, the Carolina Cougars, the San Diego Conquistadors, the Memphis Sounds, the Baltimore Claws, the San Diego Sails, and finally the San Antonio Spurs. All right, now I can take a breath. There we go. He set the ABA single game scoring record this year when we said he got to 50, because he erupted for 62 points against the Floridians March 6, 1971. His record lasted almost a year until Zummel Beatty, who we'll talk about next year, scored 63 points against the Pittsburgh Condors. After his ABA career, he joined the Indiana Wizards of the All-American Basketball Alliance League. So Stu is in leagues I never knew existed until today. The All-American Basketball Alliance League, which is a quite a lengthy... I don't know what they were trying to go for with that name or acronym or whatever. Maybe they were trying to get some ABBA because it's like AABA, so maybe like I forget, when did ABBA hit it big? Like this would have been many years prior,
no,
right?
No, ABBA was, this would have been reasonably close to the ABBA's peak. Yeah,
okay,
the 70s,
so,
yeah, right.
Maybe they just wanted people to think that they bought tickets to ABBA, and in fact they bought tickets to the All-American Basketball Alliance League to watch the Indiana Wizards versus, I don't know, because I didn't know any other teams. League folded in February, was less than a month after it started, so it did not last very long. And then Johnson went where everybody goes once they are done with the AABA. They go to Iceland, because then he joined the Icelandic Division I club Arman as a player coach, and then played for a bunch of other teams that I'm not even going to try to pronounce because they feature way too many A's and things that I don't even know how to pronounce. So he was in Iceland for quite a few years after that and as a player coach. So that's a pretty interesting career for Stu Johnson.
Yeah, that is fascinating. Thanks for sharing these. Yeah, I had no idea about some of those, the AABA.
I want to learn more about the All-American Basketball Alliance League.
Yeah.
Like, I don't, yeah. Maybe the league part wasn't actually in the, like, it's listed here, but maybe they didn't add league. Maybe they had enough with the All-American. Yeah, yeah, I guess that makes sense.
AABAL, that would be a little bit much. Yeah, the AABA.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, yeah. What are you
there
do?
Was another. Why was there two AABAs? Oh,
there were
God.
Two.
In 2010, somebody else tried to make. Oh boy.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm not gonna. That's do you want to know about this? Do you want to know about this?
Is that the one where? Is that the one where it's all white people, or the one where? It's
yeah,
all
yeah.
Oh yeah, no.
Whoops.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's no good.
That's oh boy. Yeah, yeah, we're not gonna talk about that one on this show.
Yeah.
But
no.
Don Moose Lewis wanted to. With players reportedly required to be natural born United States citizens.
Oh, okay.
And players must be both of the Caucasian race.
So. Oh, that's
shockingly
that's...
didn't get off the ground, and nobody really wanted to watch a bunch of white guys play basketball. So.
Yeah, that's weird.
Oh no. Oh my God. There's okay. Yeah. I'm gonna.
Right.
Did you hear the name of this reality show that he wanted?
No, I did not.
Oh Jesus. Okay. He wanted to be called Snowball versus Broball.
Oh God.
Yes. Closing the tab. Well, all right. Hey,
You know, the president's a big fan, so he got that at least.
He was a few years ahead of time because this would have really gotten off the ground in 2019. But
right,
boy.
So then we have also Dan Issel and Steve Snapper Jones breaking into the 50 plus club here. So the Snapper, it's always nice to get him in here. He was a three-time ABA All-Star in three different cities, New Orleans, Memphis, and Dallas. He also played in Oakland, Carolina, Denver, and St. Louis in the ABA before finishing his career in the NBA with Portland, where he had grown up and he'd gone to college in Oregon. In Dallas, he actually played briefly with his brother, Nick, who was an NBA and ABA journeyman. I hadn't realized that his brother played in the league as well.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
It was one of the better three-point shooters of his era, known for his turnaround jumper. Like Mike Conley, apparently never had a tech called against him. just kind of fun. Of course,
do you think Mike Conley knows that? Like, he has to know that, right?
Oh yeah, there's like stuff written about it. You know.
Okay, good. Like he has to like be like, oh, what? Like the refs like getting mad at him. He's like, I'm sorry,
right.
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
because you got to go now that you've gone this far in your career. You can't get a T now. Like, well, you gotta really just like let it ride, right?
Like, I wonder if the, like the refs are like have like a little pressure, like, oh, like, you know, I can't be the first to call tech on him because, you know,
he's, right? Yeah, it's like, what is wrong with me? You know, why am I the like this man has had a clear, you know, his resume is perfect. Why? What is wrong with me that I'm the one that's now yelling at him? Yeah, I like that. That's a
yeah. And of course, Snapper Jones, very famous as a broadcaster. He was an analyst for NBC for 13 years. He and Bill Walton famously had a, you know, fun on-screen chemistry. And apparently no one has revealed where the Snapper nickname came from. So we can only guess what Snapper means.
Yeah, I never really... Yeah, I never understood why that came from. I mean, I just kind of accepted it as like his nickname, but I don't know if I ever actually.
I'm guessing perhaps it might be vulgar, so that's probably the.
There's a good chance that it is.
Yes.
Let's
move on.
All right, let's check in with the teams here. So these are the teams that had the most 50-point games scored for them. I'm going to break this up into NBA and ABA, or else it would take way too long. So we have to break it up a little bit here. This is our NBA teams with 50-point games in this area. You have Milwaukee with 8, San Francisco with 7, the San Francisco Warriors, I should say, with 7, the Golden State Warriors with 4. You could probably combine them if you want, but we're going to separate them just for the purposes of this. Philadelphia, 6, Los Angeles Lakers, 3, Atlanta, 3, Kansas City, Oklahoma City, 3, Boston, 2, Seattle, 2, Portland, 2, Baltimore, 2, San Diego, 2, and then also New York, Cleveland, Detroit, Chicago, Cincinnati, and Buffalo with 1 apiece. ABA teams. Go ahead.
Sorry, brief correction. Kansas City, Omaha, not Kansas City.
Oh,
Oklahoma
right.
City.
Why did I write Oklahoma City? Omaha. Right. They didn't have a team then. So,
no, they did not.
Oh, boy. Sorry. Yeah, I guess I don't know why.
Understandable mistake. So,
ABA teams. Kentucky, New York, Pittsburgh, New York Americans. There's no point. I mean, they changed names and play whatever. We're just going to go with the towns that they were in for this. Kentucky had 5. New York had 5. Pittsburgh had 4. Indianapolis 4. Denver 3. Carolina 2, the Virginia Squires 3, Minnesota, Minneapolis Pipers 2, Utah Stars 2, Washington Capitals 2, Conquistadors and Pros, Memphis Pros 1 apiece for those. As far as opponents, NBA opponents, there's a lot here, so I'm going to try to do as quick as I can. Cincinnati had 6, Boston had 6, LA 6 against them, Chicago, Houston, Philadelphia, Seattle, Houston 4 apiece for them, Cleveland, Portland 3 apiece for them, Detroit, New York, Atlanta, those were 2 apiece for those, and then Golden State, St. Louis, Phoenix, Milwaukee, and Kansas City, Omaha 1 apiece for those. And then as far as favorite opponents for ABA 50-point games, Carolina, 5 against them as well, which is pretty interesting because I know they were a pretty good team through a lot of it as well. Kentucky, 4. Denver, 4. Indiana, 3. Pittsburgh, 3. The Los Angeles Stars, New York, Dallas, Florida, Utah, 2. Minneapolis, Oakland, Houston Mavericks, Miami, and Texas, 1 apiece for that. So nobody really stands out. It's kind of evenly distributed, but there are a lot of teams, which kind of speaks to what we said is it's not one dominant guy scoring a bunch of 50-point games. It's a bunch of different teams, a bunch of different guys all over the league scoring 50-point games. So it's just kind of noise. You know, like for the first time, there's really no trend that you can pick up other than like Kareem is good and, you know, like Artis Gilmore is good. And like that's, you know what I mean? Like there's not really any like dramatic trends that you can kind of see from those team stats, at least, you know, to me initially.
Yeah. I mean, outside of a few players carrying that, there's not really a whole lot out there. I guess it's sort of interesting that Cincinnati keeps giving up so many, but outside of that, not really. I agree. The larger trends are interesting, but not really telling us a whole lot.
Must be that Skyline Chili has got everybody.
Yeah, up, so. There you go. I guess so. Disgusting.
It's so bad. It's so bad that they're like, you know what? Yeah. Screw these guys. Right. I'm going to drop 50 on them.
Screw these guys. And yeah. How dare they call this? Yes.
Stupid wet chili crap with a. Oh, God, it's gross.
But. It's not good. So a couple of notable things. John Brisker goes back-to-back games in November of 1970. He joins Wilt Baylor Elgin Baylor and Rick Barry to do so. Alvin Hayes has 50 and 25, which is the most rebounds in a 50-plus game until 2001. Rick Barry with 53 points in January of 71. This is the first in Nets history. He is the first player with 50 on 3 different teams, and it is the 10th 50 of his career. And I'm sorry, he's not the first with 50 because Wilhead would have done that already. So he would be the second with 50 on 3 different teams, I believe. And outside of that, notable is that Dave Bing had his only 50-plus point game of his career in February of 71. With 54 and 7 rebounds. Dan Issel and Rick Barry both had 50 plus in the same day, although in different games. Barry actually had it on his 27th birthday. And then Steve Jones, as we mentioned, had 50 plus, the only 50 plus for the Memphis Pros franchise history. And then Dan Issel, so he had it on, his first was on March 28th, 71, and then he has another one on March 30th, 71. However, these are not back-to-back 50-plus point games because Kentucky played 3 games in a row on the 29th, so they were bookended by another game. So, and these are the only 2 50-plus point games in his career, despite him, you know, being, I think, in the top 20 on the all-time scoring list.
Yeah, that's a fun one. Yeah, there's a lot of fun names and fun little stats in this year. I like this one in particular. It's just got a lot of fun little notable stuff here with some of these guys.
Yeah, absolutely. So moving on to 1972, we have gone to 19 games with 50 plus, 10 in the ABA, 9 in the NBA. Our leader is Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who has 5 in this season. Half of the ones that he had in his career happened in this season. Barry has 3. We have a new record for number of players with 50, 11, and the most 50-plus point games since 1963. And this is the last time the rate of 50-plus games is above 1% until 1987, rather.
So, yeah, wow.
Yeah.
that's just remarkable, especially, you know, given that... It's just, yeah, I, it's just weird. I mean, I guess it makes sense, but it's just like, wow, it's going to be a long time until we get a lot of 50-point games again. So
yes, and with the 11 players who had 50-plus, that record was only was actually tied very recently. As of this recording, Giannis Antetokounmpo tied that record in the 2019 season. Always, the season is not over yet, so always a chance that could be broken this season, but that is the first. And this also has set a record for... number of first-timers to the club with 8.
Yeah, still in effect, that record as well. But yeah, the names that we're going to talk about here, but Charlie Scott, Pete Maravich, Chet Walker, Zelmo Beatty, we talked about him a little bit early, Tiny Archibald, Willie Wise, Larry Miller, and Julius Erving. We're going to put a little bit of spotlight here on Willie Wise. I think most of the other guys you probably have heard about a little bit, but Willie Wise, I don't think we've talked about a ton here. And Remember the ABA, which is a fantastic website. We use it all the time as a great resource. Has a lot of the stats of and a lot of these fun facts here on Willie Wise that we're going to talk about here. Three-time ABA All-Star, who along with Zelmo Beatty, Ron Boone, and Jimmy Jones were cornerstones of those Utah Stars teams. They won the 71 title and made three finals. They both twice fell to division finals to the Indiana Pacers. So the Utah Stars, kind of one of the charter franchises, I'd say, for the ABA, between Indiana and maybe San Antonio as well, ones that really stood out and had some stability too, and had some good success. Nickname of Wondrous Willie. We don't make them like that anymore, man. You know what I mean? Those nicknames, nobody would be, you know, be called Wondrous Willie ever again. But I'm very glad that he was. Incredible facial hair too, late in his career. Great facial hair. Great head of hair, just great 70s. Like, he screams 70s, and I love it. It's incredible. It's pretty funny. He was working on the grounds crew for a minor league baseball team in Des Moines, Iowa, when the Stars invited him to come for a tryout. I mean, that is awesome. That's only one of those stories, you know what I mean, that the ABA could have only created. That's why, like, Willie Wise may have never played professional basketball if not for this ABA. You know, it's like completely plausible that he would never do that. And it sucks because he was great and he was fun and he was pretty good there. But yeah, he was known as one of the premier ABA defenders. There's a quote here. This is, "My first and only goal coming to the ABA was to be a great defensive player. I loved playing defense. It's always a challenge to see if I could stop guys like Rick Barry, John Brisker, and Roger Brown." Sports Illustrated once described him as the best two-way performer in pro basketball, so pretty good stuff there. And he was the only Utah Star who did not wear a flag patch on his shorts, because he was a Jehovah's Witness. Some insights on to the interesting perspective he had on his game. This is a quote from a SI Vault article back from 1974, February 25th, 1974. He says, "My overall game has suffered." He says, even though his 22.5 point average puts him fifth in the league, "in an unspoken way, the burden of offense has been laid on me. That part of the game takes most of my energy now. Wise prefer to be the 15-point scorer he was as a young pro and go back to concentrating on defense, trying to play the way Gus Johnson and Dave DeBuscher did when he watched them so avidly before joining the Stars." He says, quote here, "I looked at Dr. J and George McGinnis and Billy Cunningham and how they can jump over their men and drive recklessly, and I wonder how they'd be if they were anticipating pain when they moved. I wonder how good it would be if I could just go out on the floor and do it without thinking." So, pretty sick stuff there. But, yeah, it's Willie Wise, who we haven't really touched on too much there, but a pretty important figure in ABA history.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and yeah, definitely an interesting character. I thought there was some good. I thought really the SI Vault article, just, you don't hear a player talk really about that, about how just sort of like talking about like having like a little bit of fear, you know, like playing with a little bit of fear, like wondering like, oh, if I could just leave kind of this mental stuff, you know, out, how good could I be, you know, that kind of stuff. I just thought that was really interesting, and just, you know, that thing they focus on, and obviously, you know, led, as you talked about, you know, was one of the key players for a really, really successful team that, you know, won a championship, came close to, you know, a few others. I got knocked down by the Pacers a few times, who are obviously the big dynasty of the ABA. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, yeah. I mentioned before, yeah, like Utah and Indiana seemed like real kind of from the East were kind of the charter franchise. And then a few other ones is obviously that popped up as well. But yeah, Utah probably doesn't get their love as much as kind of one of the better teams of the ABA, just because, yeah, obviously the titles didn't always go there. But they got one. They got 1971.
Yeah, absolutely. So a few notable, there's a lot of games here, so we won't go through all of them, but Pete Maravich and John Brisker end up having 50 on the same night, but in different leagues. And a fun fact, Maravich and Brisker were born only 7 days apart. So very, very close in age. Chet Walker has the first... has the first 50 plus in Bulls history. He has it at age almost age 32, just a few days shy of his 32nd birthday. And Kareem has he had 3 50 plus in 10 days out of 10 50 plus for his career. So the final one was 53 13 and 9 on 70 true shooting percentage. Zelmo Beatty has he ended up having 63 to set the record for most points in ABA history, which lasted about a month. He also had 15 rebounds and 83 true shooting at that point. And Willie Wise and Tony Archibald actually had 50 plus in the on the same night, but again in different leagues. And Zelmo and Wise had their 50-plus point games 2 days apart for the same franchise. So fun one there. And then Larry Miller ended up breaking the record. We talked about this in a previous episode because he's one of the more obscure players to 50-plus, but he had 67 in on March 18th, 1972.
Yeah, and unfortunately, Zelmo Beatty, I mentioned he broke Stu Johnson's ABA record for points scored by getting 63, and then just like less than a month later, Larry Miller goes and drops 67, which that's going to be tough to top there with Larry Miller. But yeah, Larry Miller, one of the rare he's got like an all-time great scoring total, like all-time great there with 67, so it's pretty fun. See, just about anybody can do it sometimes. So, and does it without, as far as I can tell, its stats are a little tough, but looks like no three pointers either. So just straight shots and free throws. He was 17 of 23 from the free throw line. So that certainly helps a lot too. But yeah, pretty interesting there that he does it without the three.
Yeah, that is interesting. Rick Barry has his third playoff 50 plus in his career out of 15 total in pro history. Julius Erving has his first 50 plus. It happens in the playoffs, 53 points. And he and Charlie Scott both did it for the Squires that season. But by the time Erving got to 50, Scott had defected to the NBA, left Squires. So they didn't quite do it as teammates, but they both did it for the same team in the same season. So close enough, I guess. Yes.
I like these two league things where you guys just, you know what? Screw it. I'm going to the NBA.
Yeah,
like,
right. Like, yes.
You know what? This is stupid. I'm out. It's good leverage. I mean, I guess.
So.
You can do that to the big three right now. You could say, hey, I'm not liking my spot. I'm going to go to the big three.
Yeah.
But probably not because they don't play in the same season. So that would be I mean, you should just play in the NBA. You should probably just do the NBA right now. But hey,
that makes the most sense, probably. Yes, I agree with you. So going into the 1973 season, we're back down. The rates drop significantly in the ABA. We only have one ABA 50 plus point game and nine in the NBA. Tiny Archibald is our leader with three, and we have four new members of the club this season. Adding to all the new names that we're getting in this club.
Yeah, this is a fun little year as well. In terms of new guys, George McGinnis, Phil Chenier, Jeff Petrie, and John Havlicek. So just an odd, eclectic group of people there. We'll bring up Jeff Petrie a little bit more here. I think we've talked about some of these other guys quite a bit, but I don't know that we've ever delved into Jeff Petrie too much. Original Trailblazer, the first star, really, of the Trailblazers there. He's a 1971 co-rookie of the year. He's also a two-time All-Star. He's only the second guard to score 2,000 points as a rookie. Oscar Robertson, the other one that does that. He's credited as the first NBA player to switch from Converse to Nike, which is a bold move at the time, but ended up probably being a pretty good idea. And now, obviously, it seems like wild now that, like, Nike, what is this upstart Nike? You got to wear Converse's, kid. Like, that's what everybody wears in the 70s. That's pretty interesting. He was traded to the Atlanta Hawks in a deal that led to Portland picking Maurice Lucas in the ABA dispersal draft. Before he could play for the Hawks, Petrie had knee surgery because of chronic injuries, and unfortunately never played again. So yeah, that's kind of a fun fact too, that like, it really, I mean, it was a great pick, obviously a great trade for Portland, but yeah, it's kind of interesting that, their original star, their biggest player, ended up becoming a big deal, in terms of getting traded and getting traded from Maurice Lucas and really not becoming synonymous with the success that Portland would have, in the late 70s there, unfortunately too late for him. Later, he was GM for the Kings. Really good years as well. And then some not good years too, but there were good Kings years and then there were bad Kings years with him as GM. And I really remember him as more of a GM than a player. Do you kind of have the same as well? Like, I kind of forget that he was a player and that he was a good player too. I always remember him as the GM though, for sure.
Yeah, and his career was pretty short-lived as a player, but he absolutely was, for six seasons or so. Yeah, it's a little bit like Brandon Roy in terms of, like, he was a big star for a short period of time. Happened to be for the same franchise, Yeah. I think, right.
You're making Portland fans very sad.
I'm sorry. Well, you got a championship out of the Petrie trade, so I guess it was worse for the Hawks there. So the Hawks got, not that important, but... In terms of bad Hawks memories, it's up there. So, yeah, unfortunately, you know, they, yeah, he was definitely, you know, a very good player at a, you know, a good career. Was not, I don't think quite Hall of Fame level career, but definitely a, you know, very good one. Been interesting to see if he could have stayed with Portland and, you know, been part of that success, if that would have worked out. But I guess probably the mix they had was almost perfect, that adding anybody significant to it probably would have not made it work quite as well. But yeah, as you said, I thought the there's an SI article that was interesting in terms of looking at him in 2002, how talking about how his front office impact made him compare to Jerry West, the GM, after he had been compared to Jerry West, the player, during his career. So I thought that was kind of interesting. Fortunately, as the Kings stopped having success, yeah, those comparisons, you know, kind of fell off. But, you know.
There was a time. I mean, there was a time where, yeah. I mean, the Kings were, I mean, it's hard to believe there was a point where the Kings were like a model NBA franchise. I swear, I promise on my, that it was a thing for a while. It didn't last long, but it was a thing for a while. And now, I mean,
Well, they're okay children now. They're okay this year.
They're getting better, but there were children. There may be people listening to this that don't believe it, but there was a time where the Kings were a good franchise.
So
That had stability and drafted well and played in the playoffs, but not now. But hey, they're close.
No, you know? Yeah, maybe next year.
Yeah, De'Aaron Fox is doing his thing there. So.
Yeah, it's cool. No.
All right, let's get to sorry, not to interrupt you there. Anything else on that year?
No. You go ahead, Rich.
Okay, cool. I just want to break down a little bit of the positions here. That I think is a pretty interesting thing to kind of jump into here. NBA, so the positions in this era that scored 50-point games. Centers still dominating the field at 32%, but that's not nearly as much as it was in some other instances there. Forwards, as designated by Basketball Reference, 22%. Guards, 26%. And then the forward guards, 6%. Forward center, 8%. Center forwards, 4%. And guard forward, 2%. But essentially, they're the big ones there. Center, 32%. Forward, 22%. Guard, 26%. So pretty even disbursement there. For the first time, I think, in this series, we're seeing that the big men are not the only ones, or not the dominant ones, at least in you know, still the highest, but not, you know, all the way like completely dominating the field like they were in prior years. And it's even more interesting in the ABA, and this I wonder is a result of the 3-point shot or floor spacing or whatever, but ABA position, small forward, 40%. So the majority of 50-point games in the ABA coming from small forwards. Shooting guards, 17.1%. Power forwards, also 17.1%. Point guards, 11.4%. And centers, 11.4%. So I thought that was fascinating that centers were as low as they were, and that small forwards were kind of the dominant 50-point game scores in the ABA. As far as win-loss records, if you have a 50-point score in a game, you're going to win 84% of your games in this era. You're going to lose 16%. In the ABA, which is perfect for the ABA, you're going to win 65.7% of your games with a 50-point score, but you're going to lose 31.4%, which I found pretty fascinating. It feels like it should be much, much higher than that, but it is the ABA, so, you know. Like,
it is,
of course, the ABA would have, like, not a guarantee if you guys score 50 points you're going to win a game. I like that. That's perfect for that league. Yeah,
it's absolutely perfect. Yes. So, it's interesting to see the positional difference between the leagues. And obviously, I think the reputation for the big men was better in the NBA. And Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's probably driving some of that, and maybe a couple of the guys.
Sure.
And you know, the ABA, obviously, you know, they had incredible forwards. You know, Rick Barry, Julius Erving, John Brisker, you know, those type of guys who, you know, mostly forwards, and a few guys of those guys regards, George McGinnis later, you know, so that does make some sense, but it is kind of interesting how that shakes out. Yeah, not, you know, there were some great centers in the ABA, but not really primarily scoring centers. I mean, you know, so that does make some sense.
And that was one of the things that made the ABA, I think, so fun to watch and fun to kind of follow is too, is that it was like sort of this changing of the guard in the NBA style, where it was like, hey, you had some good big men, but like the guards and the forwards, and these guys are high flyers and they're shooting and they're doing all this sort of stuff. And it's like, oh crap, like it's a whole different ballgame here. So yeah, I found that it got represented pretty well here in that positional breakdown for 50-point games. But
absolutely. Yeah. So going through a few of the games in 73, Tiny Archibald in November of 72, he has 51 and 14 assists, which tied the record for most assists in a 50 plus point game. This record was broken in 2017. And George McGinnis has the only ABA 50 plus point game. This is the year after Rick Barry, John Brisker, and Charlie Scott all defected to the NBA, and Julius Erving tried to, and he had 58, 16 rebounds, and 8 steals, which set a record for steals in a 50-plus point game. Now, this is also, I believe might be the first game in which we have steals recorded in a 50 plus point game, because it was, they were recorded in the ABA, not recorded yet in the NBA. So the Intrepid box scorekeeper apparently kept that in that individual game. But so, but I, it's hard to imagine there were a lot of games where there were eight steals. Although, you know, with Will, you never know. Will could basically break numbers whenever he wanted to. So, yes. Let's see, Rick Barry, back in the NBA, has a 50-plus point game. This is the first for Golden State after they go to be from being the San Francisco to the Golden State Warriors. And then he and LeBron, so let me, this is going to be maybe a hard one to explain, but.
All right, here we go.
So he and LeBron are the only players who have 50-plus with the same team in different stints. So obviously Barry was with the Warriors twice and LeBron was with the Cavs twice. And also four separate franchise tenures. So, for example, Barry played for the Warriors, got 50, played for the Capitals, got 50, played for the Nets, got 50, and then the Warriors again and got 50. So,
got it. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Okay.
Yeah. So four separate instances with the franchise, even though it was the same franchise in two of those occasions, it's still, I think, you know, four different tenures. So, and then this was the 15th 50-plus point game of his career. So, and then... yes, Jeff Petrie actually had two in this season, just a couple months apart. And his, again, maybe a little surprising to see him on this list, but his 21.82 points per game average is actually 37th all time. So, you know, you're in the top 37 all time points per game scorers. That says something about your place in NBA history, even if it's a bit of a shorter career. And then John Havlicek, he has the 17th 50 plus point game in playoff history. Is his only one of his career, and he was the oldest to score 50 plus for the first time. That record would be broken in 2000 by Cliff Robinson, and he would be the 50th player to cross a 50 plus point in a game. So
there you go, friend of the show, Cliff Robinson.
Yeah, absolute friend of the show. Yes, very good friend of the show. Yes.
Jason Cliff Robinson
loves the show. Loves me and loves the listener. Show. Yeah, so yeah, he definitely avid listener. Yes. So the final year of our look here is 1974. It is there were seven games total, five in the NBA, two in the ABA. Rick Barry is our leader with three overall, as he has been for most of these seasons. And then we have three new members to our club.
Yeah, we got Bo Lamar, Bob McAdoo, and good friend, downtown Fred Brown. We talked a little bit about Fred Brown, but we'll do a little bit more here. Known for his long-distance shooting, playing most of his career. Before the NBA three-pointers, which is an unfortunate, is that good long-range shooter, but didn't play when the three-pointer was around, so it's unfortunate there. Played for the Sonics his entire career, 13 seasons there. At the time he retired, he was tied for sixth for most seasons spent with only one team. Had a bit of a slow start to his career. He was competing with guys like Lenny Wilkins, Dick Snyder, and John Brisker for minutes. Really just emerged as a scoring star in 1975 when Bill Russell became the coach, with he and Spencer Haywood leading the team back to the playoffs and pairing with Colt favorite Slick Watts in the backcourt. So a pretty famous Seattle team there. When Lenny Wilkins took over as coach 1978 season, he decided to make Gus Williams and Dennis Johnson the starting backcourt and bring Brown off the bench. He dubbed Brown instant offense, and the team made the finals in 1978, and then, of course, would win the title the next year in 1979 with that combo. So he was kind of your Jamal Crawford type. You're you know, you are good enough to start, but we think you're better coming off the bench type guy, which, you know, the Manu Ginobili role we talked about many times, the Jamal Crawford role, like being that great six man. Jason Terry for many years as well was that sort of guy, so definitely a pretty good role for him. Led the league in three-point shooting percentage in 1980, the first year the league used the new rule. I was 44.3% in only 88 attempts, but that was 15th in the league. Went on to have a career as a banker after his playing days as well. But yeah, I'm fascinated to see how he would have, I mean, you're talking about the end of his career and he's shooting 44.3%. You know, obviously it's only 88 attempts. It's not that much, but yeah, you wonder, had that the 3-point line been there for a while, you know, how would we think differently about him? Maybe he'd be a little bit more of a prolific scorer than he was. You know, obviously he gets a 50 point game in this year, but you can imagine him, you know, for how good he was at long distance shooting and doing it without the 3-point line. It would have been pretty interesting to see, you know, how his career would have changed, you know, with the inclusion of that 3-point line.
Yeah, he definitely seems like a guy who could have benefited from being, you know, like 10 years later and, you know, being in that era. So, but he was a very good player for the one he has. I'm sure, you know, he's happy with his career, but that definitely seems like he might have been a guy who that would have changed a little bit, or if he'd been able to play in the ABA or whatever. But I'm sure he liked getting paid on time, so probably preferred the NBA over the ABA.
Right. Yeah. Getting paid and your team not immediately, like, folding on any given night is certainly
Yeah.
You enjoy that, yeah. The fruit. That, yeah. The finer things in life, like, you know, getting paid or knowing that your team is going to exist the next day. So
right. It's good. Yeah, it's important. So we've got a – so going through a few of the games in 74 – as you mentioned, Rick Barry has three of these games. George McGinnis in January of 74, he has 52 and 37 rebounds. He joins Wilt, Mikan, Baylor, Pettit, and Mel Daniels in the 50-30 club. No one has done it six. And 16 offensive rebounds in this game. This is the most that has been recorded in a 50-plus point game. Now, offensive rebounds have not been recorded in many of these games. Before those were really kept track of separately. So it's definitely possible, and I would say perhaps pretty likely, given one of those crazy Wilt rebounding games where it hasn't broken. But as far as we know, this is the most that's been recorded. So,
yeah.
And then Bo Lamar, who I forgot to mention, is Columbus's own Bo Lamar. So, and
oh my god, this list is Columbus studded up and down.
Yeah,
man, wow.
And teammate of Larry Miller at this point as well, also from Columbus. So two Columbus players in San Diego.
You're making this up. There can't be this many talented people from Columbus, Ohio. There's no way.
I swear, Rich, that is true. I would
I thought
not
you
lie
were. I thought you were Columbus' finest son, but apparently you're not.
Apparently not. Apparently it's Bo Lamar. Yeah.
So apparently it's Bo Lamar. I didn't know that. So.
The Pacers end up giving up 50 one night after getting a 50 in a game.
That's incredible.
So
that's awesome.
yes, and Bo, he had 50 points on 46 shot attempts for 51 true shooting percentage. So not the most efficient one, but hey, I'm sure the Qs they took the win. I'm sure they were happy.
Absolutely.
They didn't get that many wins, so I'm sure they were happy for that one.
What's interesting too is so he's 3 of 9 from three. So it wasn't like he had a lot of three pointers in that game. And he was like 3 of 5 from three point line. So where was he shooting from? Was he just like a horrible at layups, or was he just like he loved 19 footers? Like what? I'm just fascinated by these numbers. Like you would think with that sort of number there that like, okay, well then he's got a bunch of free throws or whatnot. Like no, I don't understand. Like why did he shoot so much? Where was he shooting from? Because they weren't threes and they weren't free throws. So I don't know where he was. I'd love to see a game tape on this Bo Lamar 50 point game. But
yeah, and 19 to 35. It could be worse.
So. I guess.
Yeah, I guess. And we have Bob McAdoo getting the first 50-plus out of five of his career. This is the first in Braves Clippers history. In fact, he was the only Buffalo Brave to score a 50-plus in his career. And he had 52 and 22 rebounds. So a nice stat line there. And Rick's, going back to Rick Barry, his stat lines this year were pretty interesting. He had his first one was 59 and 9, his second 51, 6 and 11, and then his final one on March 26th was 64, 10, 9, and 5 steals. So very close to a triple-double there with 5 steals. This is his career high in points, his only 60-plus point game, and he passed Elgin Baylor for his 19th 50-plus point game, which at the time was second in NBA history, obviously only in pro history, only behind, of course, Will Chamberlain.
Yeah.
So. Mm-hmm. And then Fred Brown's 58 points, 6 rebounds, and 3 assists, 2 steals there for against Golden State, actually. Yeah, so against Rick Barry's Golden State Warriors. And these actually happened 3 days apart, although Golden State's was the final one was against Portland. So and Rick had 45 shots in this game, but 64 points, 45 shots, not too bad.
Am I correct? And this is the Rick Barry's the 64 that Barry had in March. I think that's the first 60 pointer since Wilt in 69. Does that sound about right to you? I'm looking at these other guys because it was Stu Johnson who obviously had 60, Zummel Beatty, Larry Miller, all ABA guys, but Rick Barry doing it NBA. I think he was the last since Wilt in 69, that last final Wilt year. I believe was the last one if I'm looking at that correctly. Yeah, it is. Okay, interesting.
Yeah. Absolutely. So, yeah. So we are through this the era, the Rick Barry era, you could call it, I guess, with him. Although again, not really. One dominant star. More.
No. Jabbar's there too, but not like dominant enough. I'm kind of surprised. I assumed when I saw this era that it's like, oh, here we go. It's the Wilt era. It's the cream era, I should say. And he appears, but he's not like any more dramatically there than Rick Barry is, or a few of these other guys too. I mean, there's a bunch of guys we've said a few different times. We mentioned their names or whatnot, but Yeah, I think it's fitting to the 70s and the late 60s that it's just like there's not really one guy. It's just like a lot of dudes, you know, doing this thing here. But yeah, Kareem and Barry probably the most dominant of those. But yeah, it is spread around pretty evenly.
Yeah, like I said, a lot of new members to this club, not really an exclusive club anymore, but yeah, definitely a fascinating look. This has been fun to dive into these games and, you know, find interesting stats and find interesting trends and all that good stuff. Hope everyone is enjoying it, and you can let us know if you're enjoying it or not enjoying it, I guess, by finding us on Twitter or Facebook at Over and Back NBA. And if you enjoy what we're doing, you can leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher, wherever you listen to your podcast. We're pretty much on every platform. And you can find us at The Step Back at FanSided. And it's a great site with a lot of good basketball coverage. We're, you know, kind of winding down in the regular season, going to be getting into the playoffs soon, going to have a lot of fascinating stuff happen. So it's a great source for really interesting perspectives on NBA past and present. So check that out. Anything else, Rich?
No, that's it. Yeah, this is a super fun episode to kind of get into some new names and some new people and new leagues and all that some stuff. But yeah, no, I'm good. I'm done.
The ABA will be closing down on us. We'll be getting into the end of the ABA era, and then we'll be getting into the late 70s and early 80s and kind of the pre-Michael Jordan era of the NBA and ABA here. So that's gonna be fun look as well. There's gonna be some interesting names that are gonna pop up there and some fun stories. So we're gonna keep doing this until I guess we get to the modern era.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thanks everyone for listening, and we're back again soon.